Welcome to Dose of Depth Podcast. I'm your host, Deborah Lukovich, and I invite you to explore what's beneath the surface of all sorts of things, including your own life. Through conversation, stories, and education, you'll see what you couldn't see before, find new meaning in old events, and even discover a new sense of purpose out there in the world. Let's get started. In this episode, I'm excited to have a chat with my new depth psychology buddy and a fellow alum of Pacifica Graduate Institute. Dr. Craig Chalquist is the Academic Program Director of Consciousness, Psychology, and Transformation at National University. But first, if you're enjoying Dose of Depth podcast, please like, subscribe, and share your favorite episodes. And consider supporting my production of free content as a Dose of Depth monthly supporter for $5. A former psychotherapist and longtime graduate instructor and administrator, Craig teaches and writes at the intersection of psyche, place, philosophy, myth, leadership, and dream. In addition to two dissertations, Craig has published books that span genres, but all seek to understand how intricate linkages of selfhood, folklore, relationships, places, history, and earth intersect to re-enchant our relations with the world and each other. You could call Craig a lifelong learner, as evidenced by his willingness to go through the PhD journey twice. The journey to master a small slice of knowledge and then be tasked with discovering something new to add to the field is life-changing. By now, you're familiar with my own story, where answering the irrational call to study depth psychology for unknown reasons saved my soul. Answering another irrational call to research and explore women's experience of reconciling sexuality and spirituality through C.G. Jung's theory of individuation ended up unleashing buried parts of me into the world. Here I am. Those who feel compelled to repeat the journey are truly special people who likely are being called further into the future than the rest of us to bring back and communicate knowledge that we desperately need to expand consciousness. And this is an urgent task these days. I know that's a lot to take in. I love Craig's mind, but even I was overwhelmed by the comprehensive nature of his dissertation, which is titled Restorying Our Lore, Fiction, Vision, and Imagination as an Earth-Honoring Wisdom Path. Two of his books are specifically about Terra psychology, which you'll learn about. One is more practical and titled Change the Game, 20 Strategies for Inventive Real-Life Problem Solving. And another is a work of fiction titled Soul Mapper, a novel. One more thing, to embrace one's status as a PhD is an awkward experience for many of us. Being different or nerdy or quirky is difficult in the world, and some may even feel threatened or intimidated by those of us who have an insatiable quest for knowledge and to contribute towards consciousness raising. We're weirdos. I find myself honestly just blurting out sometimes, I just know some stuff about some stuff. That's all. That saying about how the more you know, the more you realize you don't know is so true and humbling. So don't be afraid of people who know more than you. Many of us are introverted, intuitive people who are just passionate nerds. It might take a while for our work to trickle down into the everyday lives of people, which is where Dose of Depth comes in. I'm trying to accelerate that. My chats are for regular people who want to be stretched and sense the importance of their own self-reflection in these times. C.G. Jung said something like, "The fate of humanity depends upon the self-reflecting individual." I think you're going to be challenged by our conversation in a good way. You will want to set aside your mind, though. Instead, just allow our conversation to be absorbed by your body and your unconscious without needing to grasp the meaning of what's being said. Craig's work is about our relationship with the feminine, our unconscious, which is meandering and not straightforward. Our relationship with the feminine is tied to our relationship with nature, the body, sexuality, other humans and beings, and the planet. Do wonder about what parts of your body get activated during our chat. And if you catch yourself daydreaming or losing focus, stop the recording and allow your unconscious to take you somewhere that needs attention. So let's get started. Well, welcome, Craig. Welcome to Dose of Depth.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So maybe we can just start with you just telling us what's going on in your life.
Sure. Thank you. Well, first of all, maybe where I live, which is in California in a rural town called Fillmore, a farming area. So there's crops growing all around me. It's kind of nice. And lots of different, lots of nature out here, lots of different animals and insects, and that's great. And the week was typical in some ways and not in others. I recently defended my second dissertation, this one in philosophy and religion. And so after that, that's the fun part, right? The getting asked questions and answering and everyone congratulating you and so on. But then there's making sure it's technically sound. And I'm a bit sloppy with things like citations. So now I'm having to pay for that. And I'm going through and correcting everything. So that's okay. So that's not part of my usual routine, except this week. I'm also working on a second novel. So I got to do some writing. And that was good. I'm an academic program director at National University. So I chair the program on consciousness, psychology, and transformation. So we started our spring quarter last week. So overseeing that, as well as the classes I'm teaching. So that's kind of the high points, I think.
Yeah, that's a lot. Wow. I think it's funny that you think it's fun to like answer all those questions, but maybe it's because you've already been through it once. I wasn't kidding in my intro when I said I was really overwhelmed just by the table of contents in your dissertation, because it was like every word, I just felt like every word. And I feel that you've probably always been more aligned with your feminine than most people who even do have a good connection with their feminine. And so I consider myself sort of a slow learner. So I'm wondering, my question is there a thread that you saw throughout your life at one point that maybe you were unknowingly following, which informed this thirst that you had? And to be called to do one PhD is a big journey and venture, but to do it again. And also, you know, anybody pursuing a PhD, it's irrational anyway, because we do it for just a love and obsession with something. We're not typically rewarded economically, for sure. And I have a bunch of debt right now. So, you know, and as debt psychologists, we're always challenging convention. So, you know, so doubly we're going against the grain. So I was just wondering about like, how is your unconscious poking and prodding you? And, you know, at some point you did mention that your dream world became activated with archetypal images. So however you want to share that, but I'm just wondering like, you know, how you see it all.
Yeah. So, not too long ago, but some years back, I realized that I was using depth psychology and also different things that I was into. I've my trainings in family systems as well, and some eco-psychology, and that I was using these for my own philosophy, putting them together in my own way, my own wisdom path. And I remember reading in Sean Kelly's dissertation, he was my committee chair for this, and I'll have to paraphrase, I don't have it exactly, but he basically accuses Jung of doing metaphysics on the side, on the sly. And it's not a criticism of Jung. It's just him pointing out Jung was a philosopher, even though he said he was an empiricist, you know. And I thought, I think I've been doing that too in my own smaller way. You know, I think I've been using depth psychology as a philosophy. And I'd been put off from philosophy, even though I read it, because of the language, especially Western. And these big systems that they build, which I have zero interest in. I don't care how many categories the mind has. None of that matters to me. I don't care why the chair appears the way that it does. So it put me off for a long time, but gradually I was discovering other people like Margaret Cavendish who actually had something really vital to say. And these were sometimes silenced voices in philosophy itself. So then that kindled my interest. And there was dreams that came up and things like that. So I realized that I wanted to learn more about philosophy from real living philosophers, which I did, and step out that way more and say, this is what I do. And I think of it as depth philosophy. So I think that was part of the path. And then just bunches of imaginal characters showing up. some of whom appear in my fiction as well. And they were prompting me too. So.
Oh. Oh, okay. I love that. First of all, philosophy is like, that's interesting to me. And I don't know if I'm the only one, but sometimes like I don't can't really tell the difference between depth psychology and philosophy. So now I feel a little better about that because I can't always separate it. And one man that I've actually, he is has a PhD in philosophy, and his dissertation was looking at sexuality, sex education through a philosophical lens. And so, I went to his place and he showed me like all these books on philosophy. And I'm like, can you point to one that'll just help me like ground myself? Because I just kind of float, but maybe that's not a bad thing that I'm kind of confused by it. So I like the term depth philosophy. Okay, so you have to share like a character or one of these dreams that was really striking for you.
Well, I've dreamed about Sophia, I think, my whole life. And when I read Jung's Red Book and Black Books, and the Black Books are his journals, and I now teach, but I teach the Black Books at Jung Platform and the Red Book to my graduate students. Sophia comes up in all these different forms and advises him, argues with him. I don't know if he ever recognized who she was. But the character's soul, it's pretty clear if you read Gnosticism and mythology, it's pretty clear that she's Sophia. And I was talking to Lance Owens about this. He was on my committee as the external reader, and he's probably the world's expert on Jung's relationship to Gnosticism. And he goes, "Oh yeah, it's Sophia." So I
Oh,
went, "Yay!" I
interesting.
was, you know. So,
I've actually never had, oh, I'm sorry.
yeah.
Before you go on, I've actually never had the chance to chat about the Red Book and the Black Book. So, do you mind like just doing a couple of minutes
Oh,
to
sure.
share with my listeners like what is the Red Book, what are the Black Books, and also like Sophia, like I think most people are like, well, yeah, Sophia is like a symbol of wisdom, but maybe just a little bit on that.
Sure, glad to. So Jung's Black Books, if I can talk, are his research journals. And by research, I mean active imagination, vision, dream, things like that. And he kept them for steadily for 19 years, although it got more sporadic toward the end. And so, if you want to read Jung's journals, read the Black Books. And then he ended up taking an excerpt that lasts about 4 years through the beginning of that journey into the unconscious. And he added interpretation to it, some artwork, which is just fantastic. I love his art. And that turned into the Red Book. So, the Red Book is an excerpt from the Black Books. And the name comes just from what the cover looked like, the colors of the color cover. So, the Black Book and Red Book both are just incredible journeys in which Jung talks to characters that we tend to say we make up in imagination. But what Jung quickly discovered is that they make themselves up and that they're autonomous and have their own opinions and values and saw things that he didn't see. And in this, Jung is drawing on an ancient tradition, which I studied in my dissertation, that uses imagination as a form of deep knowing. And Jung was well aware of that tradition. So Sophia, literally her name means wisdom. And there, archetypally, I understand her as not just wisdom, but she's got sisters all over the world. So White Buffalo Calf Woman and Athena and Saraswati in India and Nuwa in China and others who are similar archetypally, but each has their own story that's culturally specific. So right from the beginning of the journey, Jung was calling out for what he thought was his soul because he felt soulless at the age of 39 or 40. He was very successful in what he did. He was a psychiatrist who had just married, not all that long ago, the second richest woman in Switzerland. And so, you know, he was okay on that level, but he just felt empty, like a lot of us do when we reach that age. So this feminine figure shows up, who appears more often in the Red Book and Black Books than any of the other characters. So I think he got tutored by Sophia.
I love it. I remember the moment that I like now I'm like, why did I ever think this? That like imagination and fantasy isn't something you do. It's like you receive. Right? It's re you receive these images. You don't do them or don't make them. And so, that totally changes then your perspective about the meaning that it's something mysterious, it's something unknown. And yeah, I love it. That also reminds me then, I think of one of his books that more people have read, of course, is Modern Man in Search of a Soul, which could be written today, right? It could be published today. So even what you just described, that's really what I'm trying to focus on, is working with those people who, yeah, I should feel happy, but I don't. And then there's guilt, and I don't have a right to, for women, it's like, I don't have a right to choose me. For men, it's like, there are rules that I have to follow, and a role that I have to play, and I don't want to hurt other people. So yeah, I mean, 100, well, like James Hillman's book, we've had 100 years of psychotherapy and the world is getting worse, right? So anyways, oh, okay, so dream. Tell me about one of those dreams.
Yeah, so just numerous dreams with Sophia showing up, and I have a birthmark on my right forearm that I understand my birth mother, I'm adopted, also had a birthmark near the same place, which doesn't usually happen. And so there was a dream I had a long while ago, actually, but there was a Sophia figure in it, and in the dream I had my hand over the mark, and she said, "Hey, Kane, why are you covering up your mark?" And I woke up the next day and thought, I really need to get into this dream. So
Oh my
lots of
gosh.
indications over the years to stay on my own path, whether that's through academia
Okay.
or before that doing psychotherapy, and now writing, especially writing fiction. And the characters who are in my fiction, most of them have appeared in either in my dreams or in active imaginations of my own. And one of them, the
Oh.
protagonist of my first novel, showed up probably a year before I wrote it, maybe longer. And I didn't know what he wanted at first. And then I found out and I went, okay.
Oh my God. Oh my gosh. You know what I really love? I love when depth psychologists write fiction. Like, I don't know if you've read any of Dr. Susan Rowland's books. She has, oh my, I did an interview and she said I asked the best questions out of all the interviewers, but I was a student of hers, right? And I was like, oh, everything she's trying to accomplish through that book that as a reader, you don't have to know. But you're just absorbing it, you know? And I'm particularly interested in how she uses marginalized people, people of marginalized groups that we tend to like have feel sorry for, which is different than empathy, right? And how they become like the heroes or the heroines. So we're going to talk about your book because, you know, artists sometimes are conscious, but this is how I talk about it. They're sometimes conscious that they're a vessel for, I call it creative intelligence, right? And so, you know, when we receive, and if we're receptive, we create something in partnership with it that can't be created only from us, and certainly can't be created by the creator without using our human experience. And so sometimes artists are, you know, aware of that, and other times they're not. They think they're actually doing the writing. And so, you know, for somebody with sort of our sensibility to be able, I mean, I don't know, what a gift. It's just a different source of fiction. So I'm excited to learn about it. So let's see. Okay, we went all kinds of places with that question. So preparing for this reminded me of the book, The Wounded Researcher, which for me, when I read it, I had a numinous experience, I think. So for my listeners, you know, that book was making us aware that there's always a hidden unconscious agenda. And the moment I was like, I don't think I can trust anything I do. It was kind of like startling to me to get that. But even for researchers, like we think we know what we want to study and we think we know why, but we really don't. And the deeper unconscious agenda has to do with serving humanity, you know, once we can get over ourselves. So, I didn't know why I went to Pacifica and I didn't know what I was going to research. I was passionate about education though. So Clifford Mays, I like really loved his stuff, but that also, like when I thought about it, exhausted me. So then around this time, I was in one of Dr. Susan Rowland's classes and the first 50 Shades of Grey movie came out. And I was so intrigued by the opposite reactions, the like liberation on this end and the like, oh my gosh, the no, that's abuse, like on this end. And in class, I was so embarrassed. We were talking about what are we going to write our papers on? And I was like, I don't know. I just think there's something about this like range of emotion. And I was so embarrassed that that's what I wanted to write my paper on. And Dr. Rowland was like, well, there's definitely energy there. I suggest you follow it. That was like the beginning. And then I ended up exploring women's experience of reconciling sexuality and spirituality through Jung's theory of individuation. And then that ended up being key to my own unleashing. So I didn't plan any of that. And I don't know, thank goodness I just sort of trusted. And I always say, like, my unconscious totally kicked my ass. I was a late learner coming into relationship with the feminine. So anyway, and then, oh, and then the ancestry part, you know, the other thing I think he talked about was that sometimes our research question and even our life is like the attempt to answer a question that our ancestors did not get to. So then I just doing active imagination made me aware of things about my ancestry that I didn't see, that then gave me an insight about how I showed up in my marriage in a way that sort of compensated for. So just so many insights. So I'll to ask you the question about sort of the connection between your personal and archetypal parts of your life quest. So you talked a little bit about like why you pursued these interests, but you know, how did you get led to your research topics and the questions that you ended up asking and exploring?
Ancestry has certainly been up for me, and it surprised me when I was younger that it's not for most adoptees. And I don't know if it's just because I grew up in a chaotic family or what, but I always felt like there was a deeper story. So I went looking for everybody in my 20s and found them. And there was a deeper story. So that was part of it. And I like Jung's idea about speaking to what our ancestry is. A lot of mine has been, I traced birth families and then all the way back, just kept going, you know. So a lot of violent conquerors and soldiers, and some of my family fought on the wrong side of the Civil War. Some of my ancestors burned down Rome. Napoleon Bonaparte was one of my ancestors. Just lots of soldiers, you know. And both my fathers, birth and adoptive, were military. And I, in my psychotherapy years, I spent a lot of time in men's groups counseling military veterans. And I still have some as students. I really love working with military veterans in different ways. So that was all certainly part of it. I have not served in the military, but I have felt compelled to work out my response to that kind of ancestry and the fact that I live in a country in constant war. So some of my work addresses that, I think. So that's certainly part of it.
Yeah, the thing that I learned in and it was through active imagination, and I don't remember who was telling us to do active, maybe it was Dr. Rowland again, and we were supposed to draw, and I was really mind, right? I'm like, oh, really? What am I supposed to draw? And the only thing I would ever draw is like flowers for some reason. So I started with a flower and I said, me. And then all of a sudden my unconscious took over and I drew three big suns and I labeled them mom, grandma, great grandma. And then I label three small moons. No, two or three moons. And it was my father and my stepfather. And I noticed that I never knew a grandfather. And there were never like those men, they weren't around. And that all of my mother and my grandmother, my great grandmother were kind of mean, but there either were no men around to help them or they were bad men. Or they would come back and be abusive and whatever. And then my father and my stepfather, I saw as weak, that they weren't even able to, like, my mother had very dominating energy. And so I thought, well, no wonder they're all mean. There's no men around. So it like gave me a different way to like understand their meanness. And then I did a dream council where I invited a couple from my ancestry, not knowing, I don't know who they are. And I said, why are you here? And they said, something was stolen from our family. And I said, what? And they said, the love between a man and a woman.
Wow.
Oh my, that just like hit me. And so I'm very, very interested in the masculine and feminine in both men and women and the patriarchal wound that not only women carry, but men carry. They carry a different kind of wound, but it's really a severe wound. So anyway, yeah. Well, oh, thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, growing up in my family, which was violent because of my dad, I think it turned me into a feminist before I even knew what that word meant, because I saw what he did to all of us, and especially my mom and my sister. And so when I was at Pacifica, I had a series of dreams where a figure that looked like my dad kept showing up and arguing with me. And in one of the dreams, I confronted him and I said, "I thought we worked all this out a long time ago." And the figure said, "I'm not your dad." And he started to glow and he got really large like a god. And just as I woke up, I realized that he was my version of Zeus. And so I sat with that for a while and talked to some classmates about it. And they asked me really great questions like, where are you, Zeus? Where's your divine masculine, your connection to the divine masculine?" And for me, Zeus was just a philanderer who neglected his responsibilities, and I wasn't seeing him archetypally at all. I was seeing him through the lens of everything that had happened. So that dream helped me be more in touch with the masculine side of things, which my groups had helped with as well, working with all those men for 6 years, and then having good male mentors and things like that. So especially in college, I had a great teacher in college like that. So that was all helpful in repairing that rupture, you know.
Oh yeah, 'cause I mean we think it has to do with like, we're angry at, the father, but really it's like we've split off this part of ourselves and we're taking it out on your inner masculine. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And in addition to that, I mean, Jung was so right when he said that if we have a father, let's say, complex, then we're blocked from the divine father. And the
Oh.
same with mother, you know.
Yeah.
So after those dreams, I went, "Okay, yeah, I'm getting it now." He was right
Wow.
about
Yeah.
that.
And it, well, yeah. And isn't it, well, oh, that just really, confirms that you can know a concept, but not know,
Yep.
knowing, well, I love one day I asked, I, Googled like, what is the root of knowing? And it's to relate, which means body. So yeah. Oh, love that. Okay. Now let's talk about tarot psychology. It's Jen Degnan Smith that turned me on to tarot psychology, and she's like, "You got to talk to Craig." And I'm going to do a little bit of reading from your words for my listeners because I know they haven't heard of tarot psychology, and I love the way that you break it apart on your website, and it's so like I get it, and then by the time you're done, you're like, "What did I just read?" But I felt it, like I absorbed it, but I don't really, you know what I mean? So you describe tarot psychology as a field of imaginative studies, ideas, and practices for re-enchanting our relationships with the world. And I don't think re-enchantment is really has made it down to like, the masses, that concept. And tarot psychology explores how terrain, place, element, and natural process show up in human psychology, endeavor, and story, including myth and folklore. And then you have these three headings or these three sections, and I love it. Like your first one says, everything converses. We are restoring and thereby re-enchanting our relations with the world and therefore each other and with ourselves. And tarot psychology is a deep psychology, not only of humans, but of everything we interact with. And then your next section is the environment is you. I think that's like a great, people like only a couple words and then they can remember, right? I think that's so powerful. And that tarot psychology began as an inquiry into our deep and usually unconscious relations to the places, to places. And then your third section is new stories for coming home to our home world. And I love it. What links us to places and animals, breezes and floods, towns and homes, and strangely willful everyday objects travels along bridges of symbol, metaphor, image, and dreams. It's just beautiful. So there's a lot of concepts there that my listeners have never heard of. And so maybe you can pick out your favorite, but re-enchanting, I think, is like, you know, that just hasn't made it to the masses. Restoring. I love the idea of tarot psychology beginning as an inquiry. And then also this like linkage, that this bridge, what is that about? I have this image, the bridges symbol, metaphor, image, and dream. So wherever you want to go.
When I was a graduate student at Pacifica, I was soaking up a lot of kind of on my own. It wasn't really part of the curriculum back then, but a lot of environmental psychology, our relations with nature, things like that. And nature was kind of my safe place to go when things were violent at home. And I've since met lots of other people who that's true for. And so I wanted to understand a little bit more about our psychological relationship to nature. And Jung addresses it over and over again in his work. So that piqued my curiosity. But I found it all, with the exception of Jung, I found it all very literal. You know, that what's, you know, do people walk faster in so many lumens of sunlight kind of stuff? And I just was not interested in any of that. I was more interested in how the presence of the places where we live shows up in our dreams and in moods, conversations, things like that. So when I was kind of wrestling with a doctoral topic, you know, the clock is ticking and it's like, okay, I got to get serious about this. And I had a dream in which, so I was living in San Diego at the time and I had just ended a relationship with a woman I was seeing, a social worker. And we decided to just not be in touch for a while, to just kind of see how that went and then to get in touch later. So I was still mourning. And in the dream, there was a figure who looked like her. And so I called her by her name. And this figure gave me an angry look and said, no, that's not my name. And on the side of her face, dreams are so marvelously strange. She frowned at me, but the frown went all the way down the side of her face to her neck. And I thought, that shape is really familiar to me. And so I was starting to wake up from the dream. And I said, who are you? And she said, San Diego. And as soon as I woke up, I remembered that the bay looks like that on a map. That San Diego looks, if you look at it a certain way, it looks like a giant face, like I always think of it as a witch's face. So Mission Bay eyes, Point Loma nose, and the bay itself is the mouth, you know. And I thought, what is going on here? The usual dream theory ideas don't seem to apply here. Like, is she, Jung would say, is she part of your inner feminine, your anima? And that just didn't really go anywhere with me. Hillman asked me that too at one point, when I was discussing this with him at Pacifica. And so that didn't really resonate. This character is part of me, that kind of fell flat, you know. And the more people I talked to about it, the more they said, well, what you might need to do is get back in touch with the indigenous worldview that's at the back of all of our ancestries. Maybe that really was San Diego as a presence, you know. Nothing mystical, just we're always in the field of a place where we are, you know. And so I had done case histories as a psychotherapist, so I began to do a place history of San Diego to see what was going on. And she started talking to me more and more in my dreams. So go over here and look at this, there's something wrong with me over here, or go up on the freeway there or whatever. And it was always true. So that was the beginning of my first dissertation. And I found out there were two other people at school who were looking at similar things. So there was three of us doing this at the beginning, me and Lolly Mitchell and Matt Cochran. And so we started corresponding and conversing together. And so eventually the word tarot psychology floated through my mind. I called it something else in my dissertation, but that was the word we eventually chose. So that's where it started. How do places get inside us like that?
Oh my gosh. Oh, I love that.
Jung helped me with, he really helped me with his personification idea that, or observation rather, that the psyche has this incredible ability to make anything into a character. And so, you know, 20 years later, I can't tell you how many times me, my students, my colleagues, we all have place dreams where characters walk in and tell us true things about these places, because it's the presence of the place that's speaking to us. I was teaching tarot psychology in San Francisco once, and we were doing a little tour of the mission around the school, so the mission district. And so we kept seeing all these highly symbolic characters, events, costumes, things like that in the streets. And at one point I told my students, you know, this is so activated now that all we need is the woman with the red dress. And a woman in a bright red dress came walking around the corner at the exact moment I said that. So it happens all the time. Yeah.
Wow. This is something new that I want to pay attention to, because I don't usually go that way. Now I am aware of what kind of place like I feel comfortable with. So for example, I do need to be near water. So I don't need to be on a coast. I grew up near Lake Michigan, but even in Milwaukee, which is like right there, the lake is right there. I was very involved in bringing back our urban beach. And, but if I would drive too far west out to the suburb, I literally would be like, I can't breathe. Right. And the idea of my former husband wanted to retire in Arizona and golf. And the whole idea of like, I don't know, using water to keep golf courses in the desert feels so abusive to me. But anyway, I was like, no, I wouldn't be able to breathe. Like, I need to be near water. And during my midlife unraveling, like now I can see how being called to that community project to bring back the beach was because things were going to start happening. My life was going to start falling apart. And this was my place. It was my place. And I just knew it was calling to me. And I sort of just always looked at water as like the unconscious is being stirred up. But it was a comforting place for me as well. So yeah, I mean, I think that This is a new level, and this is, I think, what's most needed for people to start to reflect about their relationship with place, but not for like our benefit, but what is place saying to us? How is place communicating to us because it's being harmed?
Yeah. Part of what we study is that, and we warn people who are first doing this, like a lot of graduate students have used our methods to study this relationship. And we always tell them, when you go to damaged places, be sure to have plenty of emotional support, because you will feel it 10 times as intensely when you start doing this. And it always happens that way. So at first it's hard work, because whatever happened to the place shows up in you in symbolic form, and it's tough.
Well, right, because that's that connection between the personal and the archetypal, right? Like the place is speaking right to your wound, man. It's all in the wound. So yeah. Oh, I love it. Okay. So, all right. So we talked about place and tarot psychology. What, just share a little bit about what re-enchanting means to you, and then you can also bring in, if you want to, Enchant Veil community. But like, what does that mean to you? And who used to talk about was that James Hillman too that talked about enchantment? Or I don't remember who it was, but I was like, oh, enchant, like to live with a sense of enchantment. I love that.
Yeah. He was more a disenchantment guy.
Oh, okay.
but I think there's enchantment in his work. You know, he wouldn't agree, but I think there is. So when I was a kid, I read a lot of science fiction and fantasy, and I had, like all kids do, a rich imaginative life before it gets drummed out of you later. You know, mine never quite departed. And by the time I got to college and read Jung, When I came across parts of Memories, Dreams, Reflections that talk about his encounters with imaginal characters and that they have their own kind of reality, I felt hugely affirmed by that. That was a life-changing moment for me. I thought, okay, I wasn't just wasting time or, you know, any, you know, the things that people often say, right? It's only fantasy and all that. And, you know, you go and see an inspiring movie and you walk out of the theater and go, well, now I have to get back to my ordinary life. And I would think, why? Why can't our life be like that? You know? So I noticed that the more depth psychology I was picking up, the more I was paying attention to my dreams, the more places and even objects seemed to be in conversation with me, that I was moving out of the Western worldview of only humans are animate and intelligent in a dead world or a mute world. I was moving away from that into a whole chorus of presences that were always talking either to me or each other all the time. And I think it's healthy not to be in the center of that conversation, to realize that the birds are talking to each other more than they're talking to us. Although occasionally they talk to us too. Or something happens when you're walking on the trail and you get a symbol. I actually came across a little kid's toy the other day. It was a puzzle piece. And I've been looking for a missing puzzle piece symbolically. You know, something that I'm trying to make a decision about. So I love those moments when the world talks to us. But it's a much bigger conversation than human. And I think that's part of the enchantment of it. So all of that to say, it's possible for us to live in a re-enchanted world and worldview.
Like we always put ourselves at the center. So I love how you said, no, that they don't care about you. They're all having a conversation on their own. They don't really need you. So it's more like getting yourself invited to that world. In fact, that's how oddly, this is what's coming up for me. So I have always I've been thinking a lot about, you know, what do people with autism mirror back to the community, right? And it's always really an invitation that society doesn't really answer. They think that they have to fix something. And so because autistic people are more deeply connected to their inner world, it's like they're mirroring back, you know, come here into my inner world and maybe, you know, you need to go into your inner world. So it's like all about this, like turning inward. So, you know, I actually did have an experience at Pacifica with a hummingbird. It blew my mind. I told everybody and they're all like, did that really happen, Mom? So we were, maybe it was at the end of a dream tending workshop with Dr. Eisenstadt did a dream tending weekend. And the last day we were supposed to go walk and do a walkabout and just see what spoke to us. And my mind, of course, very quick, I saw the fountain. I was like, well, yeah. And I'm like, no, that's too obvious. Too easy. No, I already know I'm drawn to water fountains, right? So I kept walking. And then I walked down that sidewalk with all those shrubs and it just ends abruptly. And so do the shrubs and the shrubs hummingbirds like. And I actually had never been lucky enough to see more than one hummingbird at a time. And they were everywhere and you could hear the whirring. And I looked around and nobody was around. I'm like, am I the only one seeing this? Like, why isn't anybody around me or is like this for me? And I'm like, okay, keep going on my walkabout. I didn't get it right. So I walked. And then when I walked past the shrubs, silence. And I was like, oh, I think I was supposed to turn around. And so I walked back and one hummingbird, I'd never even seen one land on a tree. I just saw him in the air and it was chirping. And I was like, I walked closer and closer and it didn't move. And it chirped, chirp, 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 or however that noise it makes, whatever it is. And I'm like, me? Like, and I knelt down and it was, and I said, I don't know what you're saying. 10 minutes. And my mind was blown. I didn't know what it meant. And my partner said, oh, I think you were looking in the mirror. Because I have sort of this like flitty hummingbird energy to me. So I was like, okay, well, that makes sense. But hummingbirds kept showing up randomly in different places. And I don't know, I just considered it a kind of spirit animal at the time. I still don't know the meaning, except that I was beginning to like shed my persona, my professional persona, and just be okay with being nerdy, quirky me. So I don't know, but those are amazing experiences when they happen.
Yeah, very confirming too.
Yeah. So, okay, so well, let's talk more about something that you're, you know, one of these things you're offering to the world, which is this Enchant Veil community. And I love, I'm going to read your quote on your website. All my work in depth psychology, eco-psychology, philosophy, mythology, storytelling, psychotherapy, and consulting has concentrated on two increasingly urgent questions. I agree with you about the urgency. One, how might we learn from and move beyond our old guiding stories about who we are, where we belong, what it's all about, to create new cycles of keystone fictions that move us into more just, equitable, and enjoyable possibilities for living together? That's so much. And then two, how might we outgrow our insularity and rejoin the great conversation of all living beings? So, yeah, what's that about? And I think you have like a free version and a paid version. And like, tell us about that because I think people are going to want to check that out.
Yeah, that comes right out of my doctoral work the second time around. Those were the questions I was getting into in that. And I've wanted a social media platform for a while that is sane and actually optimistic in some ways, because I am. And sure, we need to know what's going wrong. You know, no, we otherwise we're in denial. But there's only so much of that a person can take. And as a culture, I think we tend to be addicted to the abyss. We sure didn't when I was growing up, but I think we are now. And so I created in Mighty Networks a sort of alternative social media platform for people who are visionaries, creatives, who want to share some hopes. And they do talk about different, you know, difficult things now and then. But, you know, I launched that about 3 weeks ago, and there's about 30 people in it right now. But it's pretty quiet. And I checked in with a couple of people. Is the functionality okay in here? Is it, you know, is it understandable how to use it and things like that? And they all gave me the same feedback, which was, we're kind of sick of social media altogether.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that's why it's so quiet in there. I feel that way too. So it's there for whoever wants to use it. It's free. There's a paid level that has to do with talking about storytelling vocationally and professionally in a deep
Ooh.
way. So the word I coined for that is lorology. That's what I do. Whatever hat I'm working under, I tend to look at people's I call them keystone fictions. The stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and where we're going and things like that, and where are they stuck? Because even in my psychotherapy days, I always noticed with my couples, my families, the men's groups, where we have symptoms and distress is where our story is too small, our guiding story. So how to open that up a bit, and also how to bless it for getting us this far and recognizing that, but maybe modifying it, changing stories, it depends. So.
I love that. I have like so many of my clients are like, oh, just wanting to bust out of the old. But, and this is how I think about Gen Z too. Like, they are very aware that systems are coming down, man, and they're all for it. And because we are waiting for new ideas to emerge out of the collective unconscious, right? By all of our self-reflection, we don't know what it looks like. And so the anxiety is really about that. Like the anxiety is like it's this fear of not knowing, I think. So I suspect that a lot of people also have to like rebuild the capacity to even experience reenchantment, right? Like that could be part of what's missing is what they're sick of is like this old way, but how do you get going again? How do you spur your imagination again? How do you share what seems like a silly idea or, you know, or whatever? And of course, people who write science fiction, that's exactly what they're doing. You know, I just saw the characters from Star Trek who said, We are going to be okay and evolve. Star Trek says so. And I
Yep.
was like, wow. Yeah, I mean, science fiction usually is like right on. But I feel like maybe there's this, I'm really interested in Jungian film theory, and films really, really work on me. So I feel like there's been this phase of being addicted to a certain dystopian story. But I recently saw a really good Netflix movie that was dystopian, but very surprising ending and very good, like a hopeful. It was very different, right, than the typical ending. So anyway, so yeah, I love it. Re-enchantment. I also wanted to read this statement that you make, and I just love it. The just, delightful, and earth-honoring society of mature human beings waiting up ahead will not be imposed by powerful elites, giant religions, vast armies, or financial empires. Lasting change grows from seeds planted and watered by imaginative, quiet people with no outward influence. My platform brings them together. And that reminds me of, I don't know this. I don't think it's not an exact quote, but I always say that Jung said something like, the fate of humanity depends upon the self-reflecting individual. So all of my clients, like, they know, even if they're like, I don't know what you're talking about, I'm like, you have no idea how your self-reflection and how you show up differently in the world is actually contributing to all these little, ooh, insight, 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 insight. And then all of a sudden something new like bursts out of the collective unconscious. So I love it. I'm going to send people to your community.
Thank you. There's on this topic, there was an exchange Tolkien had with a couple of his fans who were disappointed that Frodo didn't complete the mission of getting rid of the ring in The Lord of the Rings. And Tolkien's response was really interesting. He said, well, first of all, no one could have done it, right? Because he was completely, he went further than anyone could have. But he said, did you not notice that it wasn't the powerful kingdoms or the armies or the wizards or anybody like that who saved Middle-earth? It was a small band of hobbits who just wanted to go home and tip a brew.
Yeah, so oh, it's such interesting times. That's all I got to say for now. I'm always connecting whatever I'm talking about to, the bigger picture of the chaos happening is it is driving consciousness raising, expansion of consciousness, and it's a messy process. So, I'm on a mission to grow this movement of self-reflecting humans so that they realize that their self-reflection actually contributes to the little new insights going up. And then just like in the 80s, when everything unleashed having to do with women, the angry feminine, the rage, the buried rage, we had Thelma and Louise, but we also had like Lifetime Network that brought consciousness raising to domestic violence. We had the passage of the Violence Against Women Act. This all happened within a couple of years. And then also finally, in all 50 states, it was illegal for a man to rape his wife. Like it took that long. And so like all of that happened as like this unleashing. And why? Because, it started with Betty Friedan telling stories, and the feminine mystique was brilliant because it told stories and women were like, what? What? Yeah, I'm not crazy, basically, right? So that's going to happen again. So, and every time in the past couple of years, every time there's like some climax of hatred and intolerance, I've noticed that there's a counter increase in hunger to know more and go deeper. So all the books on racism now, they're deeper and deeper and more subtle understandings of racism, right? Like there's a book called Nice Racism, and it's really targeted towards like women like me, suburban women who are like, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I get it. But would I have gotten that 5 years ago? Probably not. So it's like the regression brings light to more subtlety, and you know what I'm saying? So, that's what's going on. So
One of my favorite, speaking of Star Trek, one of my favorite examples of that. So there's all this book banning going on in our country right now, which flares up periodically. And then LeVar Burton pops up and he goes, here's some banned books you should read. Please read these. And people do, because because he said so, you know.
There's a lot of banned book clubs.
Yeah.
Yeah. So isn't that interesting?
I hope they ban my books.
Yeah, they're right. You'll get more attention and more readers. So, okay. Well, let's talk about two of your books then. So you've got Change the Game and then Soul Mapper. So maybe share, and I'm going to share links to all this. Maybe share, because your perspective and what you have to offer, the lens is going to be different for people. So maybe share one surprising strategy for inventive real life problem solving. So like, what is one of these strategies that you share in the book?
So yeah, some of this came out of just doing this for survival and also as a family therapist and in the corporate world as well. And so one strategy for kind of moving past things is to take a current problem. There's a fancy therapy term for this, but what it means is exaggerating a problem so that different results come about. So sometimes I've done this in different venues where you take something that's an issue that people are trying to get rid of and you amplify it greatly. And it gets so annoying that people have to do something about it. And it's kind of what we were just talking about. It pulls in other forces to take care of the situation. So back when I was married, my wife at the time got desperate at one point because she was in an office ruled by a micromanaging boss. And so I advised her to have a conversation with the boss and say that basically, you know, sorry to tell you, but you're really not on top of any of this. People are doing all kinds of stuff behind your back and, you know, maybe you should clamp down harder. And so the boss clamped down so hard that a bunch of people went out they left for different reasons or went out on leaves. And the boss's boss got wind of this and fired her. End of problem. So that was a fairly manipulative thing to do. It was done in desperation. But as a family therapist, we make the term is paradoxical intervention. We do this all the time. Yeah, so that would be an example.
Oh, I love it. Well, it's kind of like walking through, like, whatever you think the issue is or whatever it is you're fearing, it's like walking through it actually happening, mm-hmm. right? Like, because otherwise, if you don't, all the unconscious is like balling up all the potential. It's like the fear of the anticipation causes the fear of like, this and this and this might happen, but you're not being conscious of like the different mm-hmm. ways it might go. And so it's just all balled up.
Yeah.
And so, oh, that's a good one. I like it.
Yeah.
So, okay. What about Soul Mapper?
So I've been writing science fiction stories for some years, just on my own, just for fun. And there's a bunch of them collected at my website in the fiction section if people want to read them for free. But this character I mentioned earlier, he popped up now and then in my dreams. And then I was in a relationship a couple of years ago where the woman I was with liked to paint, and she wanted to make not like a photo real painting of me at one point, but just kind of a stylized painting. And she painted him, and I recognized him. And she was like, I don't know why this came out like this. It doesn't look so much like you, but, and I said, I know exactly who this is. And so, it's actually, you can't see his face, but it's this guy, Lucas. He's the protagonist of my science fiction book, Soul Mapper. And it takes place in the near future. And one of the reasons I wrote it, aside from him, was I wonder what we're going to do 50 or 60 years from now when things like climate chaos are accelerated even beyond what they are now. And instead of taking a doomful approach, because, you know, there's a lot of science fiction writers now who are writing hope, because if you want doom, just read the news, right? And it has its place, but, you know, so I was wondering, what would exemplary people do? And what would people like him, who don't identify with being heroes whatsoever, what's he going to do? And I wrote the novel partly to find out. So a lot of it takes place here in California. And he wakes up in San Diego at one point at the very beginning without memory. And he's looking up at a statue of Juan Cabrillo, and he hates the man on site, but he doesn't know why. And he's sitting there and he's like, what am I doing? Who am I? Why am I here? And so he's got to figure it out. And the book's about him finding himself. So Soul Mapper is the name of it. Yeah, he informed me through a lot of it. He At one point, I thought I was going to write a novelette, and I was talking to him in active imagination. And I was out walking on a trail and kind of half consciously having a conversation with him. And he says, "I need to tell you something important." And I'm like, "What?" He goes, "I have a backstory you know nothing about." And then he told me, and I went, "Holy shit, I better write about this." So that made it into a novel.
Oh my gosh.
So
wow. You're amazing.
I said, "You're really into that?" He goes, "I really am." And I said, "Okay, I'm gonna write it."
Wow.
So that was fun.
Well, I'm reading it. And when I do read it and leave a review, then I'll remind people about it. But oh, you know what, what you said about hopeful stories reminds me of another author friend of mine, JD Edwin. She's not a depth psychologist. I met her in a writing group, and she actually works in IT. She's Asian. And we recently had we have had three chats. The last one was about vulnerability and creativity. And so since we met almost 4 years ago, she was kind enough to be a beta reader for my Your Soul is Talking book. And it was her first, like, she labeled a self-help book. She's like, "I never read a self-help book," right? And it really got her on a path. She found Brené Brown. She said, I can't believe this. I've never, like, that led to so much self-reflection, which led to her wanting to talk about her relationship with shame and her growing up in a culture of shame. And so it was like, wow. But anyway, she writes fantasy. She would call it fantasy. I would say fantasy sci-fi. And she has a trilogy of books. She's a fantastic writer. And her books, the three are done. Now she's off to another book. And I could see them being movies, actually. And her first book was the first book I read that didn't have gender. And so it was written with all they, them, there. And if you've never read a book like that, it's fantastic, because you'll realize, even if you don't think you're sort of binary, that we're trained to be, right? So it takes a long time to undo that.
Yeah.
And so eventually I was like, oh my gosh, it's liberating not to know the gender, because you pay attention to the traits, the color, and all of that. And it reminded me of reading Clockwork Orange. I don't know if you ever read that book, but some people can't read it.
Yeah.
Because it's that urban slang. And I think that probably was my first experience of surrendering to my intuition, because if you tried to grasp that with the mind, you would be frustrated. And so eventually it took on a kind of rhythm, and I could read Clockwork Orange, and it was really interesting. That was before I knew anything about depth psychology. So anyway, the other thing I wanted to say about JD Edwin is she's all about these everyday characters who become the hero, and they're thrown in this situation, and it's almost like an accident they survive, right? So it gets at this, away from this, you know, Western hero masculine that thinks he's doing it on his own. And so when I read her book, I'm like, I can't believe she just survived that. It was like an accident, or somebody was there at the right time. And I think it hits on what you're saying, is that it's a different story. It's restoring, I guess. That's what you're talking.
There's a lot of us who write science fiction who are very critical of the hero at this point. And and one of the tensions in my first, especially in the first novel, I'm writing the second one right now, is that this character has been raised to think that he should be a hero, like a lot of us, like I grew up, and he doesn't want to be, and it doesn't suit him.
Yeah.
So he has to kind of save the day from a non-heroic stance, and he has to collaborate. So the Joseph Campbell people are talking a lot about the hero as a group, as a culture, you know, and whether we call it hero or not, he learns mostly through relationships.
Well, okay. So that's like hero / heroine, right? So that's the part that's missing from the Western notion of hero, is that it's a hero / heroine, because in the end, the hero is supposed to come back to a relationship and back to the community. So that's like the feminine part of the journey, right? Like, I can't remember. I don't remember who I read anymore, but I really was like, oh yeah, it's this hero / heroine.
Yeah.
It's incomplete without the relationship part of it. Cause what's the point?
I think ideally it should be that way. But so many of our characters are hero characters in fiction and also in myth. they never come back. They ride into town, shoot things up, you know, bed the available women if they're male heroes, masculine heroes, and then they leave. And no commitment, no relationship, no nothing.
You know,
there's a great Russian folktale about two brothers named Ivan, which is like a lot of Russian tales about Ivan. But anyway, so one of them is a hero, and he has to save the Tsar's three daughters one after the other. And every time he tries to rest, a sea monster threatens the next daughter. And it's such a great story because you can see from his point of view, he is so sick of being heroic. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh my God, she has another daughter. Oh, I have to go out there and put on my armor and kill another one. And, you know, and the great thing is at the end of the story, he gets eaten by a sea serpent who is the sister of all the ones he killed.
Oh, that's good. I love it. You know, I know we got to end, but you know which movie did do a good job of this hero heroine's journey is I think it was a remake of Laura Tomb Raider. Do you remember the first one with Angelina Jolie? Well, there was a remake and it was really beautiful. It was there was father-daughter thing going on, and there was masculine-feminine thing going on, and there was a return to relationship. I think, I don't know, I think you might, I don't know if you're into movies like that, but I think you might see what I'm seeing. And there was this moment where the father, or maybe it was the grandfather, he was the grandfather actually, and he was handing over this whole whatever to his granddaughter. And she actually, to save herself, had to leave him. And there was this like really powerful moment. Like that was her coming of age, sort of having to leave him behind. But there was that return to relationship and the more collaboration in it. And she wasn't your regular hero. So, you know, women have shown that, yeah, we could do the hero role, but even that is too like focused on the one-sided masculine sometimes. So anyway, this is so much fun. We will have to have another chat. So is there anything else you want to share? I'm going to put all your links, and you do have resources where people can learn about tarot psychology. So I love that. And do you want on your email, do you have like a newsletter? Do you communicate with people? Do you want people to subscribe to you and follow you and all that stuff?
Sure. If they go to my website, chalkwist.com, there's one pop-up. I got talked into one pop-up because I hate things. But there you can subscribe either through that or through the page itself to the newsletter. I have an events newsletter that comes out once a month on the 1st.
So, Craig, thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
I always love my chats with fellow depth psychology peeps. Mm. And, you know, I love it. It just gets me fired up.
Yeah, me too. This was so much fun. I really appreciate being on.
Yeah, you're welcome. So I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Craig Chalkwist, and it inspires you to wonder more about your relationship with place, objects, animals, self, nature, and other humans. Like I said, resist the temptation to try to explore these things through the mind. Rather, feel them in the body. And pay attention to how the feminine unconscious is trying to get your attention through emotions, images, symbols, metaphors that show up in dreams and even between you and the movie screen. And one more thing, if you enjoyed this interview, please like, subscribe, and share. And also consider being a monthly supporter at $5. I'll include that link too. And until next time. I'm your host, Deborah Lukovich, and you are listening to Dose of Depth Podcast. To get updates on new episodes, my writing, and how I teach my clients to get to know that deeper part of themselves, go to DeborahLukovich.com. Oh, and if you're not ready for a coach, learn what my clients know in my book, Your Soul is Talking. Are you listening? 5 Steps to Uncovering Your Hidden Purpose. You can check it out on my website or get it on Amazon.